So, congratulations. We've come to Mark 13. We are leaving the temple. We'll see that in the very first verse of Mark 13. We are leaving the temple. And yet, while we're leaving the temple, what you'll notice is the discussion won't really shift. We're still talking about the temple. We're still talking about the events of chapter 11 and 12. In particular, and I'm reviewing these so that you know the context we're running up to, because it is so important to understand Mark 13 in light of what's just occurred. Jesus enters Jerusalem on the donkey. Very regal imagery that's appearing there. They are so excited because he's coming, and they think that Psalm 118, they're going to develop an army assured of their victory because the king is coming. Jesus goes to the temple the first time, looks around, doesn't do anything, walks away, comes back, curses a fig tree, then goes into the temple, stops all the sacrifices by driving everybody out, by pronouncing judgment on the temple. As he is leaving, the fig tree that he cursed is now barren, which should say something about the nation of Israel and Jesus' predictions about them. The very next thing that he says is, if you look at this mountain and say, go throw yourself into the sea, it'll do so if you have faith. And Jesus is standing there next to the temple. The context of Matthew 13 is predictions of the destruction of the temple, pronouncements of judgment. The authority is then questioned of Jesus. How could you be saying these things about the temple? This is ridiculous. Jesus says, I'm not going to answer your question, and instead I'm going to give you a question. And then he goes and answers his question and their question in a parable, which looks at him and says, I'm taking the kingdom from you, and I'm giving it to the people that it's going to bear its fruit. They come, throw a bunch of questions at him. They're really upset. Paying taxes, should we do it? What about marriage of the resurrection? What about the greatest commandment? Then Jesus responds by saying, well, whose son is the Christ? How could the Messiah be David's son and yet he still call him Lord? Then you have the widow's coin. And in light of all of this, conflict, destruction of the temple, then comes Mark 13. Is everybody following me so far? Very important that we don't forget chapters 11 and 12 when we begin 13. This is what I want to do, though. I'm going to read to you my thesis. If I was writing a paper, this is what my thesis paragraph would be. My thesis paragraph. I'm going to explain to you, I'm going to say to you what I'm going to explain to you over the next 2 days. Okay? It's very important for you to hear this right up front. Because Mark 13 and Matthew 24, which we'll be paralleling them a lot, can become very confusing if you don't keep this in mind right out the front. Okay? Everybody following me? This is what we're going to be looking at. In answering the question of the disciples are going to be asking a question. It's going to seem like two questions in Mark, but it is actually one question, and we'll talk about why that is when we get down to the Greek construction of it here in a bit. In answering the question of the disciples, Jesus separates the destruction of the temple and the second coming as two separate events. Okay? Disciples ask a question. Jesus, in answering their question, separates two events. Destruction of the temple, second coming. But both of these events are involved in, or are accurately described with imagery of new heavens and new earth. A new creation is occurring. Even though they are two separate events, are you following me so far? Destruction of the temple, second coming. It is accurate to describe them each with new creation language, and we'll talk about how that makes sense in context. The discourse reveals the key contrast between the two events. So a way in which he's distinguishing them is by showing how they are contrasting. The two events are contrasted by a significant length of time, number one, is what will separate them, in that the destruction of the temple will be clearly evident through signs. You will be able to see it as clear as day. You will see the signs, destruction of the temple. While the second coming occurs unexpectedly without any signs. Okay? So they ask a question. He separates the two events, destruction of the temple, second coming. And the way in which they are distinguished from each other is The destruction of the temple says it's coming soon and there will be clear signs. The second coming, he comes along and he says, it is not coming soon and you won't have any signs. Key contrast. But what is similar in both of them is that each of them ushers in a new creation, a new heaven and a new earth, a complete political upheaval where the world will never be the same. The main emphasis in both events is their inevitability and the disciples' need to be ready. Okay? Now, I know I've given you a lot right there. But I want to give it to you up front so you know where we're headed. Everybody know where we're headed? Vaguely, you know where we're headed? Any questions about that before we get moving? Okay. Mark chapter 13, verse 1. As Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "But look, teacher." Why am I stopping? The word teacher comes from one of three areas. Sedition, the subversion sedition, which that's not what's happening here. Ignorance, or a lack of confidence. And I think it's a combination of the last two. Because what have they just come off of? They've just come off Jesus pronouncing judgment on the temple, judgment on the nation of Israel, even saying that this mountain can be thrown into the sea. And you almost have a rebuttal that's coming from this disciple saying, but teacher, look, it's an outsider's perspective. He's got the wrong lens on. Why am I saying that? Because of the way in which the word teacher occurs every other time in Mark. Every other time in Mark, the word teacher is used. It is always used in that context. And this is no different. So right at the front, it should not surprise you that the question that is going to be being asked of Jesus is coming from ignorance and not an informed perspective. Right? Is that overstepping my bounds exegetically by the use of the word teacher? No, that's the way in which the word has been used all the way through Mark. Okay? So he says, look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings. To which Jesus replies, do you see all these great buildings? Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. Now, this is not the first time Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple within this context, is it? That's why I went over the first chapter 11 and chapter 12 to remind you he has pronounced judgment on the temple multiple times already. Mark chapter 11, 15 through 19, when he stops the sacrifices. Mark 11, 12 through 14, 20, 21, the withering of the fig tree. Mark 11, 23, saying throw the whole entire mountain. In Matthew 23, 38, right before Matthew 24, the key parallel passage to Mark 13. In Matthew 23, 38, Jesus says this, look, your house is left to you desolate. Pronouncement of judgment on the temple. The context is consistent. We are moving locations, but the discussion has not shifted. The temple destruction or judgment is still at the forefront of the disciples' minds, and it's on the lips of Jesus. Okay? Now, I'm going to keep doing the okay check, everybody following me, because this is a difficult passage. And I want to make sure that you're following the trajectory of where we're moving, because it will be so tempting as we're going through this to just jump off into all the baggage that normally comes with this chapter. And we'll start envisioning the second coming. We'll start envisioning the rapture. We'll start envisioning tons of different things if we don't keep tracking the context. Okay? So I will painstakingly keep asking you, are you following me? Are you following me? Does that make sense? See, I just did it there. Just a different way of saying it. Okay. Not one stone there will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. Now, real quick. Okay. If there is one stone that's on the other one, did Jesus' prediction not come true? I can't believe whenever I talk to people and they're like, well, technically, not every stone has been thrown off of itself yet. Okay. But is the temple in use? No. You want to see the temple today? You want to see what they would have been looking at in Jesus' day? Or, I mean, today? If you're standing on the Mount of Olives, and you're looking down, that's what you see today. Right here, this would have been the big wall of the temple that would have stretched up even higher. But right in the middle is the Dome of the Rock. Trust me, the Jews do not think that the temple hasn't been destroyed. So the people that will say, well, there's still one rock on the other one. Really? That's what you're getting out of this? This has to be gauged architecturally and not theologically? Really? Okay. You following my bit of sarcasm there? Like, let the passage just breathe. Its point is well made. The temple will be destroyed, go into ill use. The kingdom of Israel will be given to those that will bear its fruit. And that's pretty good evidence of it right there, just staring at that picture. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, from this perspective, obviously he wouldn't have seen the Dome of the Rock in the middle, because that doesn't occur until much later. But as this is the perspective they would have been seeing whenever he is giving them this discourse. Because it was custom, as you're leaving Jerusalem, to stop on the Mount of Olives, sit down, relax, rest from your journey, and look back adoringly on the temple. And that's what they're doing. They're good kosher Jews that are predicting the destruction of the temple. I guess I don't know how kosher you can be at that point. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are about to be fulfilled?" Okay, get ready. We're going to be diving into some of the Greek here, okay? It appears in this passage that they're asking two different questions because of the way in which the NIV has translated it. Remember, punctuation would not have been in the original Greek that we have in ours. We get the punctuation through context. We know it is a question because of the syntactical arrangement and some key words. Nevertheless, if we don't have two question marks in the Greek. Are you following me? If we don't even have one, there aren't question marks in the Greek. Well, they weren't when it was written. Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are all about to be fulfilled? They ask, when will the temple be destroyed, and what will be the sign that the temple is about to be destroyed? So they want to know when and how can they recognize it. However, the way that the Greek is actually constructed is that they're actually asking one question. That each question, notice the capital A "and" in between the two questions. That is the word "chi" in Greek, and it should be read epexegetically. Greek scholars, what do I mean by an epexegetical chi? Hopefully in Greek 3 this has been dealt with. Epexegetical. What is the function of an epexegetical chi? No one knows? It's a better way of translating it as "that is." It's an explanatory chi. It's an elaboratory chi. It's one that says, let me rephrase the way in which we can piece this together. This is my literal translation. Say to us when these things will be. That is, what is the sign when all these things are to be fully completed? So instead of asking two separate questions, really the second half of the question is elaborating or explaining what they are truly asking. Are you following me? So they say, when will these things be? That is, what is the sign when all these things will be fully completed? Now, Matthew chapter 24, if I take that question in and of itself, it still is somewhat convoluted in Mark exactly what they're asking. I think that we can make a pretty good guess of what they're asking in Mark, but I believe Matthew makes it much more clear for what they're asking. Matthew chapter 24, verse 3. Notice the construction of this is very similar. Matthew 24:3 says, "Say to us when these things will be." Same language, same construction. That is an epexegetical chi. What is the sign of your coming and full completion of the age? And Matthew, do you hear what they're asking? What are they asking? Let me read it again, and then I want you to tell me what they are asking. Say to us, when will these things be? That is, what is the sign of your coming and full completion of the age? What are they asking? What's that? Yes. When is the end of everything? Isn't that what they're asking? Now here's the problem. How in connection to the temple, they believe that that will also be the end of everything. They believe that if the temple is destroyed, everything's destroyed. The end is over. The age has been completed. What's the problem? They've taken two major events and conflated them into one. The destruction of the temple and the second coming. Well, technically they wouldn't have called it the second coming yet because they don't have an idea of a second coming. They're still thinking it's all going to happen in one coming. Right? They believe that the destruction of the temple is the end of everything. Why? Because of what the temple meant to them. The temple was where heaven and earth intersected. It was the covenantal status or marker of God's people. Therefore, whenever, matter of fact, the last time the temple was destroyed was during Babylon. But it was not done at the hands of the Messiah or God Himself. It was done by the pagan Gentiles. In their minds, if the Messiah is talking about the destruction of the temple, that means the conflagration of the earth. Everything is over. It's done. As a matter of fact, the Greek word that they use for the in both Mark and Matthew, the full about to be fulfilled or the completion of everything, is the Greek word soon-teleia. This is very important. Soon-teleia. Very important Greek word that describes the end. We're going to get into why this is really important here later today. But no, this is the word they use for the end. That's the word they use. It'll be very important once we get going through how Jesus responds to them. Okay? So what Greek word do they use to describe the end? Soon teleia. The absolute end of everything. Why are they asking this? Number one, because they're still viewing the kingdom through a Jewish lens. They cannot understand how the kingdom can still be sustained without the temple standing. And number two, because of Zechariah 14. Remember, we talked about Zechariah 14 before. When they're on the Mount of Olives, that is a very significant passage. Because their understanding of Zechariah 14 is that God will destroy everything. He will split the Mount of Olives in half. While the nations surround the city or the temple, and God will go out and fight the nations and provide the valley way in between the Mount of Olives for the escape of His people. So both their Jewish lens and where they are standing indicates that the conflation of the two events in their mind makes perfect sense. Problem is, Jesus doesn't agree. So, now I'm going to, that's what we're at so far. Now I'm going to describe to you, read to you, connection of what follows. They have asked a question. The question is, when will the destruction of the temple be? That is, the absolute end of everything. When will the absolute end of everything be? You know, which the temple will be a part of. What follows is Jesus will clarify that what they have brought into one event are actually two separate events. One of them is the destruction of the temple. One of them is the second coming. This one, the destruction of the temple, will come with clear signs, and it will come very soon. That's what he emphasizes, and we'll talk about that in a bit. The second coming, it will have a significant delay, and there will be no signs. Nevertheless, both of them are accurately described as a new creation. Any questions so far? Everybody tracking? Everybody got a good foundation from which we can now tackle the rest of this. Yeah? All right. Verse 5. Jesus said to them, "Watch out that no one deceives you." Stop right there. Very important. What question is Jesus dealing with first? Which event is he dealing with first? Let me ask that differently. Which event? Destruction of the temple or the second coming? Destruction of the temple is what some of you are saying. Why? I actually agree with that, but why? What is my argument that he is actually beginning with the destruction of the temple? Do Do I have one? Because of what everything has been driving at before. Right? While the disciples indicate a shift in the conversation, I have to allow Jesus to not shift the conversation. He has predicted the judgment on the nation of Israel, on the destruction of the temple, multiple times. Not to mention the fact that he also will overuse the words you and the second person plural verbs. You is emphasized intensely up front in this chapter. What is that indicating? Who is the you? The disciples. Watch out that no one deceives you, is how he very first starts out. Verse 5. As a matter of fact, we will see this construction of the word you being used. Mark chapter 13, verse 5. Mark chapter 13, verse 9, it's used twice. 11, it's used three times. 21, 23, it's used two times. Verse 29 and verse 30. That's just the word you itself. Now the actual verbs that have the you embedded in their conjugation is 13:5, 13:7 twice, 13:9 three times, 13:11 three times, 13:13, 13:14, 18, 21, 23, 29 twice. You see his emphasis? Number one, I'm arguing the conversation hasn't shifted. We're still talking about what he just talked about in verse 2, the destruction of the temple. And the fact that he uses you over and over and over and over and over again lends credence to this destruction of the temple. More so than the you being referring to some event that's 2,000 years away from them that will not deceive them because they will be dead before it happens. You see my thought process in that? Conversation hasn't shifted. And we need to keep asking the question as we are reading this, who is the you? Matter of fact, I believe it was Gleason Archer, who is a pre-mill. He said, regarding Matthew 24, in light of the word you, we would have to be insane exegetically to think that it's applying all to us. And he actually doesn't even agree with me on my interpretation, but at least he's being honest with the pronouns. With the pronouns. The word you is a major problem. Watch out that no one deceives you. The next question we will ask, as we are going over the next several verses, is the question, do these events that Jesus is describing match up with the destruction of the temple in AD 70? I think that's a fair question. If what I'm suggesting is right, that he initially is talking about the destruction of the temple, then we should have some clear parallels to the destruction of the temple that match up in some way, shape, or form with what Jesus is describing. Otherwise, it'd be very difficult to prove that point. Verse 5. Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming, I am he, and will deceive many. Many what? Many messiahs. Right? Yes? As a matter of fact, I gave you guys at the beginning of the semester an appendix or a list straight out of Richard Horsley's book, Bandits, Prophets, and Messiahs. And it goes through and it lists all the different prophets and messiahs and bandits that claim some sort of political movement of God's kingdom through their ministry. We see it all throughout the first century, especially leading up to 70 AD. As a matter of fact, Jerome, in his commentary on Matthew, writes this. He says, at the time of the Jewish captivity by Rome, so at the time of the destruction of the temple in AD 70, many Jewish leaders claimed to be the Messiah. There were so many, in fact, that there were three distinct camps of them when the Romans besieged Jerusalem. He says, oh yeah, there's no question. At the time of the destruction of the temple, many Jewish leaders were claiming to be the Messiah. Matter of fact, it was so overwhelming that even the city itself was split up into three different groups, each of them following a different Messiah. It seems to match up a bit. The question would be why? Why all the Messiah talk? Why the Messiah emergence? Because when you're in times of turmoil and oppression, you are looking for a key figure to lead you into liberation. And during the times of AD 66 through 70, different messianic figures were emerging to try to give people hope, to incite people to war, to battle against Rome that was coming to siege their city. And Jerome says, yeah, actually what Jesus says in chapter 13, verse 6, is exactly what happened in AD 70. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, don't be alarmed. But things must happen, but the end is still to come. We'll get to the word end in just a minute. But wars and rumors of wars, leading up to the destruction of the temple, and during the destruction of the temple, that is actually one of the key areas of time in the Roman history where the rumors of wars and actual wars that were occurring was at an all-time high. As a matter of fact, all you have to do is look at the year of 69. The right before the temple is destroyed. That's called the year of the four emperors. There was so much internal war that was going on in Rome that in 1 year, four different people fought their way to become the key ruler of Rome. Four different emperors. The emperors are as follows. Galba reigns from June 9th of 68 to January 15th of 69. So he goes into January 15th of 69. Otho is January 15th of 69 to April 16th of 69. Otho gets in there. He's there for a couple months, about four. Then comes Vitellius, April 16th, 69. He reigns until December 22nd of 69. So his reign of about, you know, six, seven, eight, 9 months is then destroyed when Vespasian becomes emperor. And he reigns through the rest of 69 all the way up through 79. Wars and rumors of wars? Yeah, as a matter of fact, Suetonius is thankful that Vespasian eventually comes and establishes the Flavian dynasty. Because he says, we didn't even know if Rome was going to survive all of the civil wars that were happening. And you add all of those civil wars fighting over the throne, while the Jews were over here revolting with their war against Rome. And this doesn't even count on the edges of the empire. The barbarians see the Roman Empire in flux, and they start to riot. They start to revolt. At every angle of the empire, everyone thought, actually, that the empire could crumble down in a matter of years because everything was in disarray. Wars and rumors of wars? Yeah, we definitely have that. That's for sure. Okay, but then he says, such things must happen, but the end is still to come. I'm not going to explain to you the word end yet, but what I do want you to notice is this. Jesus, in this verse, does not use soon-teleia. He does not use that word here. He uses the word telos. Now, while it is accurate to translate them into English, both as the word end, that is accurate. The problem is that the word end can mean multiple things. It's kind of like the word new. If you look up the word new in English, you actually have 16 different definitions in our dictionary. You have to know what type of end we're talking about. Because I would suggest that this word for end indicates something much different than this word for end. And we'll talk about that one here in a bit. But the end is still to come. End of what? Is one of the ways you'd have to define this word. Verse 8. Everybody okay so far? Everybody tracking? You know why I brought this up? I'm pointing out that what they ask about the end, Jesus says, I'm going to talk about the end. Because I'm not talking about, I know you're talking about this, but I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about this. Okay? All right, verse 8. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of the birth pains. Earthquakes and famines, yeah, we had those too. As a matter of fact, E.L. Toombs in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible says, classical and modern authors record at least 17 major earthquakes in the Palestine area during this early Christian era. We do know of one even in Asia Minor that was massive in 60. So massive, it wiped out the city of Laodicea, as well as Hierapolis and Colossae. Laodicea, the seventh church of Revelation. Colossae, the city to whom the book of Colossians was written. It's actually somewhat fascinating that during that earthquake in 60, Hierapolis and Colossae both received governmental funds to rebuild their cities. And when Laodicea was offered the same funds, Laodicea said, "We don't need your help, we'll do it ourselves." As a matter of fact, it's the similar language that you see in Revelation 3 whenever Jesus says, "You say I am rich and I don't need a thing." Laodicea had said that to the Roman government in their history, and now they're saying it to Jesus spiritually, and that's a problem. Famines is also very clearly attested both in the Bible and outside of the Bible. Matter of fact, one of the reasons why Paul was traveling from city to city was not just to encourage and strengthen and to plant churches, but he was also collecting an offering for the church in Jerusalem to help with the famine that was predicted by Agabus in chapter 11 of Acts. That did occur during the time of the reign of Claudius. Josephus, though, also describes in Jewish Wars 6.3 through 4, which we will read tomorrow. I'm not reading today. And I'll just let you know right now, it is graphic. So just prepare your stomachs for tomorrow. But he describes the famine that was going on during the time of Judea whenever the temple was being destroyed. And it's brutal. All that to say, oh yeah, there definitely were earthquakes and famines going on at the time in which the temple was destroyed. Leading up to is really more important. But why does he describe it as birth pains? Birth pains. Two reasons. Number one, when a woman is having birth pains, you know that the end of the process is approaching, but it is not here yet. It's approaching. It's coming, but it's not there yet. And number two, you also know that a new creation is about to emerge. Remember I told you at the beginning, the destruction of the temple as well as the second coming, both should have new creation language attached to them because that is in fact what it creates. We'll talk about later how even one of the shorthand ways of referring to the temple was heaven and earth. But we'll talk about that in a bit, probably tomorrow. Nevertheless, the birth pains shows that, number one, that the end is approaching. End of what is the key question. And number two, that a new creation is about to emerge. But also, a hidden third one is that it is inevitable. It is going to happen. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been around a woman when she's about to get pregnant. But you can't look at her and say, "Yeah, just hold it in. You're going to be fine. We just need to wait another month or so." It's not happening. It is inevitable. It will happen whether you like it or not. It is not up to you whether it gets to stop or to continue. It is going to happen. Whether they like it or not, the temple, like a woman in birth pains, will be destroyed. It will happen. Verse 9. You must be on your guard. Who's the you? You must be on, yeah, and you hear what he's saying. You must be on, he's saying, it will be very clear. There will be clear signs. You must be on your guard. You must not be deceived. You must be ready. You will be handed over to the local councils and flogged in the synagogues. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them. And the gospel must be preached to all the nations. We'll get to that in verse 10. But right off the bat, in verse 9, the you, if it is the disciples, does that happen to them before the destruction of the temple? Yes. Where's your evidence? Yeah. The class I'll be teaching in just 20 minutes. Acts. Over and over and over. As a matter of fact, Matthew chapter 24 verse 9 adds, "And some of you will be put to death before this happens." And that is true. As a matter of fact, a lot of the disciples were put to death before this happens. Peter was dead in 68 at least, maybe even 67. He saw the beginning of the birth pains, but he didn't see the actual new creation emerge. Paul was killed before him, although Paul wouldn't have been in this context. James, the apostle, was killed before him. Over and over and over, whether we're talking about beatings, whether we're talking about imprisonments, whether we're talking about appearing before governors, whether we're even talking about death, this does happen before the destruction of the temple. Therefore, the word you is more than appropriate. You must be on your guard, because you will be handed over to the local councils and flogged in the synagogues. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. At first glance, this seems to be a difficulty. It almost seems like what happens is, all of a sudden, Jesus jumps straight to the end of time. Must be preached to all nations. The completion of the Great Commission. I've heard about this in some class before here at Ozark. Right? Here's the problem. Can I just jump context like that? Even if it seems like it's something beyond my context, can I just say, that's at the end of time, the rest of it is 80-60, 80-70? Yeah, that seems a bit awkward. Just a little. Matter of fact, Matthew makes it a little bit more difficult to deal with this. Matthew 24:14 says, "And the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations." And then he says, "And then the end will come." But two things about Matthew 24:14 that's important. First of all, the word he uses for end is this word in Matthew 24:14. Not this word. He uses this one. Now, I haven't totally defined that yet, and I'm not going to now. We're going to wait for a couple more verses. But notice there is a difference there. Second of all, the word that Matthew uses for whole world is oikumene, which by the time of the first century, oikumene had become a shorthand way of referring to the Roman Empire. Where do I get that? Luke chapter 2, verse 1. Caesar Augustus orders a census of the entire Roman Empire. Oikumene, same word used here in Matthew 24:14. He must preach the gospel to the whole world. Oikumene. Acts 11:28. Agabus predicts a severe famine over the entire oikumene. And it is translated in our Bibles, Roman Empire, accurately. Therefore, if I was retranslating Matthew 24:14 more accurately based on the New Testament and not off the theology I want Matthew 24 or Mark 13 or Luke 21 to perpetuate for me, I would translate it, "And the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the Roman Empire, the whole Roman Empire, as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." The word that's used here in Mark 13:10 is the word nations. Another word, another way of referring to this is Gentiles. They were synonymous virtually throughout all of the New Testament. All you got to do is go to Revelation. Although the definition of the word Gentile shifts, it still is pointing to those that are outside. 1 Timothy 2:7 says, "And for this purpose I was appointed a herald, an apostle. I am telling the truth, I am not lying, and a teacher of the true faith to the Gentiles." Same word used here in Mark 13:10. 1 Peter 4:3, "For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans or Gentiles choose to do." Same word. Revelation 11:12, "But exclude the outer court, do not measure it, because it has been given to the Gentiles." What is being said? First of all, here's what's real important. We got to ask the question, does Paul think that the gospel has been preached to all the nations or to the whole oikumene, the whole Roman Empire, during his ministry? What does he think? What is Paul's verdict on this? What's that? He's always trying to get to Rome. Does it anywhere in Paul's letters indicate that what is being looked for here has been accomplished before AD 70. Let me read to you a couple. Colossians 1:6. All over the world, he actually uses the word cosmos there. Bigger than oikumene. All over the world, the gospel is bearing fruit and growing. Colossians 1:23. This is the gospel that you heard, and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. Romans 1:8. First, I thank my God for through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is being reported all over the world, the cosmos. Well, how does Paul think the gospel is advancing during his ministry, during his lifetime? Remember, he dies in 65. Well, he seems to say it's been preached to every creature under heaven. Doesn't he? It seems to be that way. Therefore, Paul would suggest this verse has been completed by the time he dies in 65. And all we needed is to have to been some sort of completed before 66 to 70. It's one of the reasons why I get so confused when people say, we need to complete the Great Commission. What? As if God's timeline is contingent upon our obedience? When has that ever been the case? That's what the Pharisees were saying about the coming of the Messiah. Once we all are completely pure, then God will be able to come back. Really? He's contingent upon our obedience. Never has been. He never will be. And I am much more comfortable with reading this in the context of AD 70 than I am of ripping this out and throwing it to the end of time. Now, it preaches a good sermon. I'm okay with that good sermon. And if people come to Jesus for it or they decide to go to the ends of the earth because of that sermon, then I'm okay with it. Nevertheless, I don't think Matthew 24:14 or Mark 13:10 teach that theology. It's in the context of the destruction of the temple. As a key sign that shows that the temple is going to be destroyed. It is forthcoming. Verse 11. Whenever you are arrested and brought to trial, do not worry beforehand about what to say. Just say whatever is given you at that time, for it is not you speaking, but the Holy Spirit. Jesus once again reiterates the key component to His kingdom. Reliance on God. Reliance on God. When all of hell is breaking loose, when you're being persecuted, when you're being destroyed and killed, whenever the temple itself is being wiped out, you know God is in control. Rely on Him. Always rely on Him. Verse 12, brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you. Who is the you? Because of me. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. Oh, what is the word end there? Now we're going to finally get to our answer to end class today. Guess what word Jesus uses here? Which word do you think? We want to say this, but He uses this again. Here is the difference between the two words. Soon teleia. In the New Testament is always used to describe the absolute end of whatever it is its object without the possibility of anything continuing after it. As a matter of fact, let me read to you some of the places it appears throughout Matthew's Gospel. Matthew 13:39, 13:40, 13:49. Every time it's referring to the harvest at the soon teleia, the end of the age when the angels will come and they will separate the righteous from the evil judge, from the evil, and then judgment occurs. You see how soon teleia is being used in Matthew 13. The end of everything, second coming language. Matthew chapter 28, verse 20. You know this one. Jesus, after His resurrection, says, "And surely I will always be with you to the very end, to the very soon teleia." The absolute end of everything. Second coming talk. Problem is, that's not what telos means. It doesn't mean the absolute end of everything. It does mean the end of a process, understanding that other things will occur after it. It is the end of a process, a sequence of events that are leading or on the way to the end goal. You see this in Mark chapter 3, verse 26. During the Beelzebub controversy, Jesus gives this explanation. "And if Satan opposes himself and is divided, he cannot stand. His end has come." He's saying His ministry is over. Matthew chapter 26, 58. This one's real important. "But Peter followed Him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the," NIV translate the word telos, "outcome of the court proceedings." He wants to know how this event's going to end. And Jesus keeps saying, "I know what your question asked. When is the absolute end of everything? The harvest of the age, the destruction of the world, the second coming," although they don't know the word second. He says, "But I'm telling you, the destruction of the temple is actually a telos, not a soon teleia. It is the end of a process. It is the end of a sequence of events. But it is not the absolute end of all events." Major difference. You see the difference here? People have to explain to me why Jesus switches the words from soon teleia to telos if He is trying to talk about the destruction of the world, the end of everything, the second coming. You see my problem exegetically? Leading up to this context, it seems very clear he's talking about the destruction of the temple. Matter of fact, I don't care what language is in there as long as we're keeping consistent with where he's at. But the language he does use seems to indicate it's the end not of everything, but the end of a process. What is the process that's ending? The temple, the reign of the kingdom of Israel that's being handed over to the people that will bear its fruit. Mark chapter 12. Are you following me so far? Okay, I want you to make sure that you don't think that I'm overstepping my bounds in this exegesis. I am very concerned about understanding this passage. Number one, because I feel like it is so abused. And number two, because I think there's a very important message for us and for understanding the rest of the New Testament. But we'll have to continue to go that place tomorrow where we will approach and deal with and define the abomination of desolation. Love you guys. See you tomorrow.